I'm really delighted to be able to welcome you here. This is part of the university's decade of commemorations or centenaries of commemorations program, where we decided for 2016 we would focus particularly on women. And when we decided it, it wasn't a particular focus of what we were seeing in other events and agendas. And since then, though, I'm really pleased to say that it has become a much wider focus. And that is actually a huge amount to do with our speaker for today, Mary McAuliffe, because she has been going around the country talking about these women. So I'm very pleased to welcome you. Myself and Dr. Una Frawley from the English department have been putting together a series of events which is tied together by issues of commemoration, memory, and looking as well, not only at the events of the past, but how we're remembering them right now, because that tells us a lot about our political moment. So Dr. Mary McAuliffe is a longtime collaborator and friend of mine, and so it really is a pleasure to introduce her. And she's very kindly agreed to come out to us today in what I'm telling you is a very busy schedule of events. I rather pedantically wanted to mark this week being the actual 100 years date of the events of the Rising, and so we're lucky to have her for this. She lectures in UCD and she has many specialties, and this has become her most recent one, but she's a longtime scholar in the area of women's history. She's the former president of the Women's History Association of Ireland, from which I took over from her. And she collaborated with me in co-editing a book called Sexual Politics in Modern Ireland. And the talk that she's giving us today comes from a collaboration with Liz Gillis, who many of you might know her from Kilmainham. She's now working in the RTE archives. She couldn't be with us today, so Mary is talking for both of them. But I love the title, We Were There. It's a declaration, and it's talking about the 77 women who were taken to Richmond Barracks in Inchicore in the immediate aftermath of the Rising, which Mary tells me Richmond Barracks has been regenerated and is opening next week. So I happen to live in that area, and I think it'll be really good to have that. And there will be an exhibition about these women as part of that. But we have also been able to get, a digital exhibition, which is happening, launching in the Intus building after this at 5 o'clock, where I can promise you coffee and cookies, which are very nice. The other thing that Mary has been involved in lately is a book on Kerry in 1916, and she has a chapter in it specifically on the women in Kerry. And that's one of the things that I've been most pleased about in this process of commemorations, is that we're understanding more about the local level and more about events outside Dublin, as well as the national narrative that's always been told. So that's really important. There's going to be a launch of that book on Kerry in Dublin on the 27th of May, and I will circulate details when we have them. So I'm not going to say any more about this, because I'll be saying a few words over on the other side in the Intus building about the issue of women, and Mary is also vastly more qualified than me. So can you just help me welcome Mary to come and speak to us?
Good afternoon, and thank you, Jennifer, for that. It's great to be down in Maynooth, and when Jenny asked me to come down, I agreed, because, as she said, we've been long-time friends and colleagues through the Women's History Association over the years, and I was delighted when Jenny took over for me, and she has taken it on to new heights as well. And all of you who are not members should join the Women's History Association of Ireland. It's online and very easy to do. So what I want to talk about today is this project, which I've been living with for the last number of years, and which seems to have really grabbed the attention of many throughout Ireland in terms of this decade of commemoration. And really looking at the women, it started with a WHAI conference that happened in 2014, when we commemorated the founding of Cumann na mBan in 1914. And since then, what the women did and why they were there and the fact that they were there in 1916 has really become one of the big stories of particularly this year's commemoration. And I always like to start with this image. It's one of my favourite images over the last few years. And it's been floating around forever, and I'd seen it before I looked at it in detail found out when it was taken. I realised this image was taken 2 weeks or less after most of these women had been released from Kilmainham Jail, where they had spent about 10 days in prison. This is a fundraiser held on in the back garden of the Mr. and Mrs. Eli O'Carroll. They lived on Leeson Street. It was the National Aid Fund, so the women, 10 days after they've been released from prison, or 2 weeks after they've been released from prison, are back as activists again. They're raising money to give to the widows and orphans of the signatories who've been executed, and also to the families of the men who are now being rounded up and imprisoned in internment camps in England and Wales and around Ireland. And many of the women here are beginning to become iconic figures. You have Kathleen Lynn and Madeleine French Mullen. You have Elizabeth O'Farrell in the beret there on the left. You have Julia Grennan. You have Rosie Hackett, of whom the bridge was named. But you also have, there's 66 women here. And the majority of those 66 are among the 77 women that I was, and myself and Liz were studying for the 77 Women Project. And a number of things strike me when I look at this image. Number one, that they're 2 weeks after being from Kilmainham. And when you think of what their experience was like in Kilmainham, they were held in the part of the prison, the old part of the prison, nearest the breaker's yard where the executions took place. So every morning, and they write about it in their Bureau of Military History statements or other memoirs they put out, every morning they could hear early in the morning footsteps, doors opening, footsteps coming back, and then gunshots. And while they mightn't have known specifically who was being executed, they knew it was men they knew. Some of them, they knew it was their fiancés, brothers, husbands, friends, because they all knew each other. Because the other thing that strikes me about this photograph is how young they are. And if you look at it, if you look at their faces, they are very young women. The majority of them, from our research project, the majority of the women that we were looking at, and I've broadened that out to look at the almost 300 women who were involved in the Rising, they're aged between 17 and 23, 24. The leaders, the older women, are in their 30s and 40s. I mean, we don't even consider that old today. They're, you know, this is a youthful generation. This is a new generation, a young generation, most of them born in the 1890s, up to 1900. So in 1916, they are between 17 and 23. And the third thing that strikes me is when you follow on their careers, as we have done in the 77 Women book, where we do potted biographies of these women, almost every single one of them will continue on as activists through the War of Independence and into the Civil War, and indeed on into the Irish Free State. And in lots of ways, you look at the promise that's here with these women. I think even though they've been through a significant trauma, and we have to see that week of 1916 and those 10 days they spent in prison as traumatic, they still have hope. They believe in what they're fighting for. They believe in what they're committing their lives to. And that's what they're doing. They're committing their lives to it. And then the failure of the Irish Free State to deliver on that. And yet they continue as activists on into the Irish Free State. So for me, these women, in terms of legacy, are an important legacy for us today. And this is me with my feminist hat talking, to look back on and see them as our foremothers. However, taking that off and putting back on my historian's hat, I want to talk about today what brought these 66 and the other women, the other 200-odd women, to fight in 1916. Because, of course, what you know, when we talk about 1916, in lots of ways we forget, it was a violent revolution. It was, at the end of the week, Dublin city centre was flattened. Almost 500 people were dead. A lot of people were badly injured, made homeless, etc., etc. It was the first time a European city had been battered like that. And it was done by the political masters and the military masters, James Connolly certainly believed that they would never have pounded what they considered a British city like that. So it was a new experience for them and a traumatic experience. So what brought these women, when you consider the types of lives women were expected to have at this time, where the dominant discourse was domesticity, where you were brought up as a respectable young working class or middle class woman to be a wife and a mother, to be within the domestic, be within the home. What brought them out? Many of them armed, many of them on the front line, many of them couriers and dispatch carriers, to a city under fire. What motivated them? And that's what I want to look at a little bit. And then the second part of that, because it's very much part of the 77 Women Project, is naming the women. Now, I won't name all 77, or we'd be here for the rest of the day, and we do need to get to the launch of what I would imagine will be a fantastic online project that Jennifer has planned, and the biscuits, of course. I want to name some of the women. Not the women we know, not Countess Markovitch or Kathleen Lynn, or indeed Elizabeth O'Farrell, although I talk about her a little bit, but the unknown women, because in naming, they begin to enter into public consciousness and more into the history books and into the narrative of 1916. So in 1913, Countess Markovitch identified three great movements, the nationalist, the labour movement, and the women's movement. And it is through these three movements that we find the roots of politicisation prior to 1916 of these 77 women, and indeed all the other women who were out in 1916. And by extension from that, also the women outside of Dublin, and Jennifer mentioned the Kerry book, but there were also Cumann na mBan members and small other organisations organising outside of the Pale. And being a Kerry woman, I'm always anxious to emphasise the fact that Irish history doesn't end around the M50 or places like that. It does happen down the country as well. So there were political women ready and willing and able and standing too in Tralee and in Cork. It just didn't happen in 1916 for various reasons, but they will participate in the War of Independence. One organisation I always like to really emphasise, which I think is overlooked in lots of ways in terms of its political impact on a very important cohort of women who go on to become the leadership women, is Éin Éan na hÉireann, which was set up by Maud Gonne in 1900. It's very much a cultural organisation, but it's also a feminist, separatist and militant. And I emphasise the militancy of Éin Éan na hÉireann in 1900, because it's one of the first and earliest militant organisations. It's militant in terms of its nationalism and in terms of its feminism. And again, looking at the images, and I think the images are really powerful in ways perhaps, or equally to the documentary evidence that we have, you see the youth of these women, girls, I mean, really, at this stage, many of them are just young girls. And again, it emphasises how this was a youthful revolution. It was a generation who had rejected, in lots of ways, the conservative, constitutional, moderate nationalism of their parents and grandparents, very much influenced by the development of cultural nationalism and that sense of Irish-Ireland identity. Many of these young women had been in the Gaelic League, and through that came to politics, the Gaelic League being an apolitical organisation in this initial period, but what it was doing was it was politicising young men and women through cultural nationalism, through developing that sense of Irish identity. And you can see from the Éin Éan na brooch, for example, very much the impact of looking back at Irish history, constructing this idealised version of Irish history. Now, we know that idealised version of Irish history was, for the most part, incorrect, but that doesn't deny the power of it and how it impacted on many of these young men and women. Éin Éan na also demonstrate what a lot of the women will show throughout their political lives, a sense of social conscience. They organised Irish classes for poor children and campaigned for the extension of school meals in Ireland. They were very much conscious of the poverty, had a consciousness around the poverty in Dublin, particularly in the tenements. The lack of access to good food, the lack of access to healthcare, And many of these women coming in through Inyan na hÉireann will go on to commit their activist lives to resolving those problems. Madeleine French Mullen and Kathleen Lynn being two of those women, both of whom are involved in Inyan na hÉireann from an early stage. They had their own newspaper, Ba na hÉireann, a very interesting read for anyone who's interested in looking at feminist activism, cultural activism, or women's expression of cultural activism. It's an eclectic mix of fashion advice, gardening columns. Countess Markovitch wrote one of those, but also an expression of their political ideology. It was advocating militancy, Irish separatism, and feminism with Helena Maloney as editor. And I realise I put an E in there into her surname. She is M-O-L-O-N-Y. The E is gone from it. Helena Maloney is a very interesting character. She's one of the 77 women. She said in she was searching for some expression in her life around 1903, and she heard Maud Gonne speak, and it was like a bolt from the blue. And from then on, and it's true, she did, from then on to the day she died, she committed her life to Ireland, to the cause of Ireland, and pretty soon, within a few years, to the cause of labour and to the cause of women. So Helena Maloney represents, I suppose, embodies those three isms that many of the women were influenced by from 1900 onwards, that new generation of women, searching, I suppose, for some expression of how to be political in the Ireland of the time. Another feature, of course, of women's politicisation at this time is feminism and feminist activism, which has been going on for much longer than cultural nationalism. But the 19th century version of feminist activism would have been very much that moderate, middle-class, educated woman lobbying campaign. Many of the women would have been of the same middle and upper middle class as those who were involved in the Irish Parliamentary Party. They would have known the men who were the power brokers in Irish society and used that knowledge to lobby for women's rights and the vote and all that. By the early 1900s, however, the new generation had lost a certain amount of I suppose, confidence in how this moderate campaign would win anything. It had won by the early 1890s, the right to vote at local level, but it seemed to have stalled then, and particularly with the growth and the foundation of the WSPU in England, the Women's Social and Political Union, the Pankhurst organisation, and its militancy, plus a sense of, I suppose, they felt they weren't going anywhere because everything had stalled after 1890. The Irish women began to, the younger Irish women began to organise themselves. And you have by 1908 the setting up of the Irish Women's Franchise League with Hannah Sheehy Skeffington and her husband Francis Sheehy Skeffington. And like Inyan na hÉireann, of course, they have their Irish citizen. Its emblem is for men and women equally, the rights of citizenship, and for men and women equally, the duties of citizenship. So very much an idea that the woman as citizen is a necessity in Irish society. They launched a number of campaigns. One of the biggest ones, of course, was to get female suffrage included in the 1912 Home Rule Bill. And they campaigned absolutely, you know, to get the Irish Parliamentary Party to include that. It was, in the end, a failure. The Irish Parliamentary Party refused to include female suffrage for many reasons. Some of them were anti-suffrage. John Redmond felt they didn't want anything to which might stymie the passage of the Home Rule Bill, because, of course, the Conservatives in the House of Commons and most of the House of Lords would have been anti-suffrage. So putting women's rights into the, or the women's right to vote into the Third Home Rule Bill was a non-starter. But I suppose the most important part of that campaign is you see a unity of purpose between the women in Inyan na hÉireann, for whom Ireland comes first, and the Irish Women's Franchise League, for whom gender is first, to campaign for the Third Home Rule Bill inclusion of female suffrage. Now, Inyan na hÉireann would have had the standpoint that they didn't want any to benefit from any legislation passed by what they considered to be an alien government. But they suspended that belief and cooperated with the Irish Women's Franchise League. there is always that tension, and I think is a marker of their political sophistication in some ways, that there's always that tension between the different groups. The Irish Women's Franchise League was very much suffrage first above all else, and they would have seen nationalism as very much secondary to feminism, whereas Éireann na hÉireann would have turned that in its head and would have seen the fight for Ireland as the primary expression of their politics, and that when Ireland was free, everything else would fall into place. How wrong they were, but they didn't know that at the time. So you can see those tensions are there, and they're a mark of all feminist activism, first, second, third wave, throughout the last 150 years. But it doesn't mean that the women don't cooperate and collaborate and form alliances when they need to. And they do that around the Third Home Rule Bill, they do that around many issues, particularly social issues, things like the ladies' dinners, penny dinners and things like that. They continue to collaborate through to 1916. And it is that formation of political networks that you begin to see a radicalisation process, because not only are they collaborating, but they're also influencing each other in terms of political activism. And the Irish, the Indian women are by the end of the first decade becoming much more radical and socialist in their thinking. And they're bringing along the more moderate middle class feminists with them as well. Because, of course, socialism is that third element which politicises women through the first decade and a half of the 20th century. And James Connolly personifies this. James Connolly becomes quite friendly with a number of the women, Helena Maloney, Countess Markovitch, Kathleen Lynn, Hannah Sheehy Skeffington. I suppose in lots of ways, we also have to remember how small Dublin was. It's small today. It was an even smaller city then. And a lot of those who were involved politically, male and female, all knew each other. And they were also all of the same age. So a lot of them would have been going to the same, you know, going socially, going to the same places, and politically going to the same meetings. And they began to get to know each other. Connolly said, what Connolly is doing is he's introducing to the women the concept of class oppression as well. The female worker being the slave of the slave, his famous saying. And I think you can see in the launch of the Irish Women Workers' Union in 1911, that expression of the three aspects of political ideology coming together. When you see on the platform at the launch of the IWW, Delia Larkin, who was going to go on to become the first head of the IWW, you can see her in the white blouse with the kerchief in the front. And again, look at the youth of these women. This is the first photograph of the Irish Women Workers Union. Many of these are Jacob's factory girls. They're 14, 15, 16, 17 years old. They're teenagers. But on that platform in 1911, you have Delia Larkin, you have Countess Markovitch from Éireann na hÉireann, and you have Hannah Sheehy Skeffington from the Irish Women's Franchise League. Markovitch, I suppose, in a way, what she says represents what the thinking is. She said the union, the IWW, such as now being formed, will not alone help you obtain better wages, but will also be a means of helping you to get the vote. So you can see the combination of gender and class coming out there in what the women are stating and what they are saying by 1911. Perhaps the one space, the first space, 1916 is where all these women are comrades, but they're also comrades in the 1913 lockout. And it's a very interesting space in terms of considering the unification or the unity of purpose that's beginning to happen between a lot of the feminist activists, the class activists, the socialist feminists, and the nationalist women in this period. And this is before the formation of Cumann na mBan. With the lockout, you have 20,000 people locked out. About 1,000 of those are women workers, most of them locked out from Jacob's factory. Their participation in the lockout, oftentimes overlooked, but beginning to be looked at again, is interesting in that, yes, you have strikers, female strikers on the front line. And I haven't done some research, and Rosie Hackett, one of her statements, talks about the fact that when they saw some of the DMP men coming, while they were on the strike line, they would run because they knew they were going to get a battering. Many of them were there on Bloody Sunday when the workers were charged by the DMP and when many of them were beaten off the streets. But where the unity of purpose comes, I suppose, unifies both the political aspects of this women and their social conscience, in that they set up the soup kitchen in Liberty Hall. And here you have an image of Countess Markovic and many of the women who are running the soup kitchen in Liberty Hall. So you have here in this soup kitchen, you have the feminist activists represented by the middle class Irish Women's Franchise League wearing their suffrage badges. You have the Irish Women Workers Union represented the women workers wearing their union badges, for which many of them have been locked out. And you have them all here operating together. And it's here because, of course, collective action and political action depends on ideology, but also on relationships and networks and forming those networks between the women. And it's here that a lot of them get to know each other personally. It's here, for example, some of them meet each other and form relationships that will last their lifetime. Because it's here Kathleen Lynn and Madeleine French Mullen, who form a couple, who become a couple at this time and are never separated until Madeleine French Mullen dies many decades later. And Kathleen Lynn talks about that in her diary, in her witness statement, the first time she met Miss French Mullen. So many of them get to know each other in this space, this activism space. They're already politicised, but now they're getting to know all the other political women. And particularly the more radical socialist feminist women get involved in the Irish Citizen Army at this time. The Citizen Army set up initially as a workers' militia in order to protect the striking workers. By 1914, with James Connolly at its head, is becoming a more socialist, nationalist-focused militia, the Irish Citizen Army, accepting men and women on an equal basis, which is a little bit of a controversial subject for historians. The women themselves regard it, the space, as an egalitarian space. Madeleine French Mullen referred to it as such to her friend Rosamond Jacob, and it is reported in Jacob's diaries. And as you can see here from this image, and it's great that so many of these images are now, with the digitization of so many archives, are coming out, and we're beginning to see images of what we believed, what we were picking up through the sources, through the documentary sources. Here you have some young Irish Citizen Army women, girls, again, their youth always strikes me, training with, I would imagine, camogie sticks. And there's a very tall figure there in a long white, greyish white coat. That's Countess Markovic overlooking watching the young girls train. And the girls are training and going on route marches, learning how to look after rifles. They're also doing the first aid. Kathleen Lynn is the chief medical officer of the Irish Citizen Army. So many of them are doing all of the things the men are doing. There is a women's section within the Citizen Army, but it doesn't seem to differentiate between what the people will do. And later on, when she's interviewed about this in the 1940s, Helena Maloney says that everyone did according to their ability within the Citizen Army. And of course, women's ability, because of the way they'd been brought up, would go more towards the nurturing and caring, food supplies, first aid, etc., etc. She went on to say that if a man was good at cooking, well, then that's what the man did. And if a woman was good at shooting, well, then that's what the woman did. So for her, and perhaps she's looking back with somewhat rose-tinted glasses, but still, it indicates in a way that the women thought of themselves as equal comrades within the Citizen Army. It was a little bit different for the organisation set up in 1914. It was set up to respond to the fact that women were not allowed to join the Irish Volunteers. Nationalist women, those who perhaps were less radical than the women who joined the Irish Citizen Army, wanted a space in which to express their nationalism. When they're not allowed to join the Citizen Army, the Irish Volunteers, even though Pearse had said there would, or Tom Kettle had said there would be work for women to do, they spend, you know, 4 or 5 months in between November 1913 and April 1914 making a decision around how to form an organisation which would express fully female nationalism within that organisation. You have women like Kathleen Clark and Jenny Wise Power, very sophisticated, politically active women who have been involved in Sinn Féin, who've been involved in the Irish Women's Franchise League, and the Éireann na hÉireann, and many of these organisations. So they're not, you know, coming to this without a certain ability or political ability. They're a self-selected committee. They don't take any chances. They also select a very moderate figure to deliver the inaugural speech because they don't want to alienate the more moderate women. And they do realise they're probably the more radical women in Irish society at the time. So they select Agnes O'Farrelly, a very respected professor of Irish at UCD, a Redmondite, a supporter of the Irish Parliamentary Party, very well up in the Gaelic League, and a very all-round respectable woman in terms of moderate politics, constitutional nationalism particularly. And she delivers the first speech at the founding of Cumann na mBan and Wynn's Hotel in April 1914. And she talks about forming a body of women for the cause of Irish freedom, and those women would fundraise to arm a body of men, which creates a lot of tension with the feminists. And again, you can see the arguments can be had without the feminists all, or without the women all falling apart. Again, a marker, I think, of their political sophistication. And in the pages of the Irish Citizen, the arguments about how this is a retrograde step for women, saying that women were auxiliaries of the Irish volunteers. Hanishi Skeffington refers to them as animated collection boxes, which I really like that expression. Whereas Mary Colum says, even if the Irish volunteers disappeared tomorrow, and she's on the committee of Cumann na mBan, Cumann na mBan could carry the cause of Irish freedom forward. Now, in lots of ways, that argument became moot because of the split that occurred once John Redmond made that call at Wooden Bridge to go, you know, the First World War having broken out, to go wherever the firing line extends. Cumann na mBan split in the very same way and over the very same thing that the Irish volunteers split. And they say, the executive says, we did not form ourselves into a body of women in order to support Irish men going to fight in a foreign war, basically. They did not want to support Redmond's speech. A lot of the moderates, including Agnes O'Farrelly, leave Cumann na mBan at this stage. And Jenny Wise Power later said that cleared the road for the work the women had to do. You can see almost immediately they become quite militant in their outward expression, as well as in what they are training themselves for. The Cumann na mBan badge certainly doesn't indicate a pacifist organisation, with the rifle and the initials intertwined. And they also have their uniform, which is modelled on the Irish Volunteers uniform. They do first aid classes, they do rifle drill and rifle practice, they do signalling, they learn courier work and dispatch carrying. So again, they're preparing themselves for something that's coming down the line. They know that there's going to be something. They may not have been involved in the intimate planning of the Rising, although somebody like Kathleen Clark would have been entrusted by Tom Clark with the plans, because of course they thought if somebody like Tom would have thought, had they failed, the women would have to carry on the fight, which in actual fact is what happened in the end. So if we look at all these organisations coming together in 1916, women who have been politicised through feminism, through socialism and through nationalism, and sometimes two of the three or all three together, it is, I suppose the question is, how come there weren't so many more women out rather than just the 300? Well, of course, that's down to the narrative and timeline of the Rising, the countermanding order. There would have been many more Cumann na mBan women out had there not been that confusion over the when the Rising was going to take place. And, you know, the loss of the 20,000 rifles coming in from Germany meant the South didn't rise. So the women in Cork and Kerry and Limerick, who were all prepared, didn't rise in rebellion. So you have it confined to Dublin in the same way with the Irish Volunteers elsewhere. They're not rising either. But everywhere the Rising did occur, you had Irish Citizen Army women in Dublin and Cumann na mBan women in Dublin, Enniscorthy, Galway and Ashburn. For them, I suppose, what it all culminates in and where the promise that sometimes I entitle these talks, Promise and Loss, the promise is in the proclamation. Irish men and Irish women, it starts with. The Republic is entitled to and claims the allegiance of every Irish man and Irish woman. It guarantees religious and civil liberty, equal rights and equal opportunities to all its citizens. So that is what brought these women to that point in 1916, in revolution. They were looking for an Irish Republic in which they would be full and equal citizens. Indeed, Hannah Shee Skeffington said about 2 weeks before the rising, she asked James Connolly if this was included in whatever proclamation they were writing. So a lot, you know, the women did know something was happening. They didn't know the absolute detail, but they did know something was happening and about to happen in 1916. It's interesting. They hear the proclamation read on Easter Monday, 1916, and during the course of that week, several times, we know from their witness statements and pension files, the women quote that proclamation back at the leaders when the leaders are telling them they can't do something because they are women. When Margaret Skinner wants to launch an attack, a bomb attack on the Shelburne to stop the British Army snipers who are stationed there and who are keeping them pinned down in the College of Surgeons, and Michael Mallon doesn't want her to go because it's too dangerous for a woman, she quotes the proclamation at him. She said, "You said there was an equality with the men. You know, it is my right as a full and equal citizen to do this." Now, she didn't do that, but she launched another attack the following day in which she was wounded three times. When Pearse called all the women together in the GPO to leave on the Friday of 1916, they refused, and they quoted his own proclamation back at him. And then he said, "Well, if you are soldiers, I'm giving you an order." So they did obey the orders as soldiers, but they didn't leave because they were women. They left because they were part of an army, and they had received a direct order from their commandant. So the proclamation comes to, I suppose, embody all of the activism that these women had been undertaking between 1900 and 1916. We know what they did. I won't go through that because I want to go on to name a few of the women, but they were snipers and couriers and dispatch carriers. They did make the food. They were the first aid people. They were in all the outposts except Boland's Mill. And when the surrender came, of the 300, 77 were arrested and marched off to Richmond Barracks, where they spent 24 to 48 hours. And then most of them were taken on to Kilmainham Jail. Now, actually, the British officers didn't really know what to do with the women, and the women who were arrested in Marrowbone Lane were all marched off to Richmond Barracks still armed. They hadn't been disarmed by the British. They still had their rifles and their guns, which they then stuffed up the chimney of the married quarters in which they were kept because they didn't really know what to do with them. But they insisted that they were part of the rebel contingent and were surrendering with them the rest. They saw themselves as equal participants. So who were these 77 women? I love this image, which shows, you know, the symbolism of removing Elizabeth O'Farrell from the surrender photograph. But I think now we can put her back in. Her legs are there again. Among them were women like Winifred Kearney, James Connolly's secretary in the GPO. But Winifred Kearney is so much more than that. She was born in Bangor, County Down. Her father was a Protestant and her mother a Catholic. She became involved in the Gaelic League. So many of them come through the Gaelic League in their teenage years. And the feminist and trade union movements with her friend Marie Johnson, wife of Thomas Johnson, later leader of the Irish Labour Party. In 1912, she had become secretary of the Irish Textile Workers Union, which functioned as a women's section of the ITGWU and was led by James Connolly. And it's in Belfast she makes a really close friendship and political alliance with James Connolly. And in the weeks before the 1916, he actually sends for her to come from Belfast, and that's why she's in the GPO in 1916. During the 1913 lockout, she was active in fundraising and relief efforts for the Dublin workers. She was present at the foundation of Cumann na Mban in 1914 in Wynn's Hotel. As well as training in first aid, the Belfast branch, of which she was a president, held regular rifle training, and apparently Kearney was a crack shot, regularly getting the best results in rifle practice. She was also a member of the Irish Citizen Army, one of the few women who was in both Cumann na Mban and the Irish Citizen Army. And it is said that she marched into the GPO with a revolver in one hand and her Wimley, or her typewriter, under her other arm. She remained in the GPO throughout the week, and she's one of three women who remain in the GPO after the other women leave on that Friday, the other two being Elizabeth O'Farrell and Julia Grennan. And the three women accompany the retreating Garrison, 2 Moore Street, and it is here that they nurse Connolly, who has been badly wounded and now has gangrene, through the last 24 hours of the rising. And she continues typing dispatches, dressing his wounds and attending the other men. After the surrender, she was interred first in Richmond Barracks, then Kilmainham Jail, then Mountjoy Jail, and then sent on to Aylesbury Prison in England. She's one of 12 women who are held longer than the 2 weeks, among them, of course, Countess Markovitch as well. She was finally released on Christmas Eve 1916. But that's not the end of it all, of course, and what we've discovered from this research is how rich their post-1916 activism is. And just to give you some detail of that, because this is really about 1916, she remains in Cumann na mBan. She's appointed president again of the Belfast branch. She was imprisoned in 1918 in Armagh and Lewis Jail in England. She visited IRA prisoners in Belfast Jail and had been party to a jailbreak. She stood for Sinn Féin in Belfast Victoria division, obviously in East Belfast. She didn't get elected, but she got a respectable 600 votes. She stood as a socialist, and she remained true to her socialist convictions to the end of her days. She was a member of the Revived Socialist Party of Ireland in 1920. She'd come to the attention of the B specials in 1922, and then had lots of seditious documents. She married George McBride, who had been a member of the UVF and fought in the First World War and was a Protestant. So, you know, I think her class activism, he was also a socialism, so their class activism overcame any difficulties. She always kept faith with Connolly's ideal of a workers' republic, although she did not realise many of those aims. An acquaintance, Martha Morgan, said after her idea was the Connolly idea of a republic. She did not agree with the new Free State government, something most of the women have in common, and she stuck with the Connolly line and maintained it right up to her death. Bridget Davis, another woman, working class woman from the tenements in Dublin. Her father was a general labourer, so that would have been one of the poorest of the poor in Dublin. A general labourer would have just got day work and day pay. She was a member of the Irish Women's Workers' Union. She was a Jacob's factory girl. She was out in 1913. She joined the Irish Citizen Army and fought with Kathleen Lynn in City Hall. She was instructed in first aid by Dr. Lynn, and after the rising was encouraged to train fully as a nurse, and indeed is one of the first nurses employed by Kathleen Lynn in St. Alton's Hospital when it set up in 1918. She continues fighting throughout the War of Independence, using her nursing training to provide first aid for men on the run, and is sent down to County Louth to nurse one of the men down there, and that's where she actually meets her husband, Paddy O'Duffy, where she nurses him. And a lot of relationships are formed as well between the women and the Irish Volunteers, which is unusual too, because they're choosing their own partners. So that radicalism is there as well. Another woman is Madeleine French Mullen, born in Malta, a middle-class Protestant background, unionist background, gets involved in the Gaelic League and in nationalist politics, then joins Éireann na hÉireann and indeed writes for Beann na hÉireann, meets Kathleen Lynn, her life partner, here, both of them here, in activism in the lockout in 1913, fights in College of Surgeons in 1916, runs the first aid section there, and indeed is the one who operates on Madeleine French Mullen and saves her life after she's been wounded, is arrested and imprisoned after the rising, and is one of the women who's held longer in prison. After the rising, she returns and reunites with Kathleen Lynn, and they set up St. Alton's Hospital for Sick Infants. They also nurse the Dublin poor through the Spanish flu in 1918. They're both members of Sinn Féin. They campaign in the 1918 election. She continues as a social activist throughout her life. In 1920, she was elected to Rathmines District Council. She's very interested in social housing. And until last year, a block of flats stood on Charlemont Street called French Mullen House, named after her. Unfortunately, it was taken down, even though it was a Michael Scott-designed house. And I think it should probably have been a listed building. But anyway, they took it down. She campaigned to have women police, women jurors, legal adoption, better conditions for women in prison and children's institutions, etc., etc. She died in 1944 and is buried in Glasnevin Cemetery and was buried with full military honours. Marcella Cosgrove, again, a woman born in inner city Dublin. Her background would have been working class. She was, again, comes through the Gaelic League. She was a pupil of William Rooney, a nationalist poet and journalist who had set up the Celtic Literary Society. From a young age, she was an advocate of women's rights and Ireland's rights. She was a member of New Anna Parnell and supported the Ladies' Land League. She joined Éireann na hÉireann in the early years of 1900. She helped set up one of the inner city schools set up by Éireann na hÉireann in the inner city and provide daily meals for the poor children. When Cumann na mBan was established, Cosgrave and Éireann na hÉireann go into Cumann na mBan as a branch on its own. And actually, it's the branch of Cumann na mBan that's based on the south side of the city. And it's the most militarised branch of Cumann na mBan. And Cosgrove is the quartermaster of that branch of Cumann na mBan. Unlike other branches which have presidents and secretaries and treasurers, the Inianni branch of Cumann na mBan has a captain, a commandant, a quartermaster, and they organise along military lines in the same way as the Irish Volunteers. And they were attached to the 3rd and 4th battalions of the Irish Volunteers. 22 of the Inianni na hÉireann women are arrested because they all insist on being arrested together. You know, they're much more united than the other branches and they obey orders from their chain of command. And so only their commandant talks to the Irish Volunteers, not all the rest of the women. And Rose McNamara is the commandant of the Inianni na hÉireann branch in 1916. Again, born in the inner city of Dublin, she was introduced to Éireann na hÉireann by Marie Perlows, a woman of Huguenot ancestry, whose sister was married to Rose's brother. Oftentimes you see these interconnections, familial and kinship interconnections. They're all bringing each other into the movements. She was responsible for organising her comrades and mobilised 24 of the Éireann na hÉireann branch, despite the countermand, on Easter Monday 1916. Half of them went to Marrowbone Lane, where they were attached to Éamon Cant's South Dublin Union Division, and the other half were supposed to go to Boland's Mill, but when they gathered in Merrion Square, a courier came telling them they weren't wanted. So the other half of the Éireann na hÉireann branch got into whatever outpost they could get into. So they were divided. 22 of the 24 women who came out from the Éireann na hÉireann branch were arrested and taken to Richmond Barracks. Actually, Rose McNamara talks about the fact that to keep up spirits in Kilmainham Jail during the 2 weeks or the 10 days they were in there, they used to dance 16-hand reels in the prison cells. So I can imagine that if any of you have been to Kilmainham, they're tiny. So I can't imagine how they were managing 16-hand reels. And they sang as they were being arrested and taken off to Richmond Barracks. And John McBride said to them, "Keep up the spirits, girls, keep singing." So they were very much conscious of keeping up morale. McNamara continues on after the rising. She's involved in the War of Independence. She opposes the treaty, as do almost all the 77 women. Only about two or three of them are pro-treaty. And that's becoming more evident. It was always said that the executive of Cumann na mBan opposed the treaty, but the main body didn't. What we're finding from this research, actually, is the foot soldiers of Cumann na mBan oppose the treaty as well. The women who are not on the executive, and they have real ideological concerns about the treaty. This is probably one of the saddest stories. This is Josie McGowan, again another member of the Éireann na hÉireann branch. A lot of the women joined the Éireann na hÉireann branch in 1915, prompted by the pageantry and propaganda of the O'Donovan Rossa funeral. For the first time, they see Cumann na mBan marching in uniform. And many of the younger women joined the Éireann na hÉireann branch, not out of ideological concerns, but because they're living on the south side of the city, and it's the only branch on the south side of the city. Again, a woman from a working class background. Her father would have been a general labourer. They lived in one room in a tenement house that we can see in the 1911 census. Two of her brothers were out in 1916. Another thing that's coming through, these women had brothers, sisters, some of them fathers and mothers. The Norgrove sisters Their father and mother and brothers were all out in 1916. So Josie McGowan fought in 1916, was in prison, was released, continued her activism. And in 1918, at a protest meeting in Foster Place, protesting against the arrest of Maud Gonne, Kathleen Clark and Countess Markovic as part of the German plot, she was there, was attacked by the DMP. Josie McGowan got hit in the head and died 4 days later without regaining consciousness. So you can see that they were really ready to put their lives on the line. It's a wonder some weren't killed during the rising. But they continued on, where many of them were beaten. Quite a number of them die at very young ages. So you wonder at the traumatic effect of their activism during this period. I just want to mention finally Elizabeth O'Farrell and Julia Grennan. Julia was arrested, Elizabeth wasn't, because she was given a guarantee when she took the surrender note around to all the outposts that she wouldn't be arrested. But one of the things that has come through in doing this research is the number of women who are forming alternative relationships with each other. There is radicalism in terms of how the women and men are getting involved with each other. They're choosing their own life, their own marriage partners, which is quite unusual at that time. But some of the more radical women are making choices beyond that in a society where, you know, homosexuality is criminalised and lesbianism doesn't really exist, isn't even thought about or countenanced. And Elizabeth O'Farrell and Julia Grennan, who have known each other since they were children, spend their lives as activists. And when we were writing the biography of Julia for the 77 Women book, we actually couldn't write it without writing a joint potted biography, because they do everything together. They're in Éireann na hÉireann, the Irish Women's Franchise League, Cumann na mBan, the Irish Citizen Army. They're in the GPO together. They leave the GPO together. When Elizabeth went out to deliver the to negotiate the surrender, James Connolly apparently had to reassure a very distraught Julia that nobody, that they wouldn't shoot a woman with a white flag. And then they spend the rest of their lives together. They're anti-treaty. They continue to be, they reject the legitimacy of the Irish Free State. Neither of them ever applies for a pension because they want nothing to do with the state. So they're on that very radical Republican edge of post-1922 politics, where quite a number of the women spend the rest of their lives. And they're buried together, as you can see, in Glasnevin Cemetery in the same grave. I'll just put her in. She's a Kerry woman, so just mention her because Elizabeth or Jenny is giving me the talk is up signal. This is Ellen Humphreys, sister of the O'Rahilly. Because of her experiences in prison, she commissioned this Harry Clark window that is now in the church in Mountjoy Jail. So you can see the social conscience carries through. A lot of them work for the White Cross after 1916. Etc. Etc. Bridget Lyons Thornton, just briefly mention her, from a middle class family, a medical student in 1916, hears about the rising when she's home in Longford, hops on a train, comes up, gets into the forecourts where her uncles and her cousins are. She's one of the few women who's pro-treaty. And just to mention, the Civil War is always seen as a brother against brother, dividing brother against brother. It divided the women too, in a very bitter way. In 1922-23, when the women were being imprisoned during the Civil War in Kilmainham Jail and the North Dublin Union, Bridget Lyons Thornton, at that stage a qualified doctor, is the medical doctor who's in charge of their care as their warder in Kilmainham Jail. So basically she's back in Kilmainham this time as the one of those who is imprisoning her former comrades. And a lot of that bitterness creates the first divisions. I mean, they'd had arguments and tensions between them all during the first two decades, but the Civil War creates severe divisions between the women from 1922 onwards. So bringing it back to these women, in 1916, here they are, having experienced the rising, still committed to the cause, all of them going to go on and fight in the War of Independence and on into the Civil War. It's the moment of possibilities, I suppose. They've experienced what they think is the worst, but perhaps they don't know. And maybe it's a good thing that the worst is yet to come. But you can see in their lives, in their histories, in their biographies, a real commitment to ideology that perhaps we had ignored among the women. It is written about with the men, looking at the men, their commitments to ideology, whether it's blood sacrifice or whether it's socialist republic for Connolly or whatever their commitments were. It's expected of men. That's the public persona of men. You see this equally with the women, and I think we have to understand in broadening out and complicating the narrative of 1916 that the commitment of women does that, and understanding what their participation does that. So these are the themes that came out, working class, youthful, politicisation. More things I want to do is looking at Cumann na mBan at a local level, and I think a lot of that research has been done among people here in Maynooth and others elsewhere. And then finally, the plug, this is the book. We were there, 77 Women of the Easter Rising, can be got from Four Courts Press, and all of the details that I've just discussed today is included in that. Thank you all very much.